You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome, everybody, to the DM Vault. I am Jake, joined as per usual by Paul and Nacho in studio. How is everybody doing today?
I'm good.
Pretty good. Nice 3.5 hour drive down 75.
Yeah. Nice little, it is actually a beautiful day for a cruise.
Yeah, with six construction zones.
Yeah, and we are joined.
It's construction season, so.
The Michigan State reptile and bird have been spotted, the construction cone and the.
The pothole?
Yeah, the pothole.
I did see a Michigan alligator, though.
Oh, yeah. Love those. We are joined today by one Mr. Dave. From Tactical Tokens, I would like to point out really quick, too, that Dave is also from New Jersey, and that we've had another Dave from New Jersey who also plays D&D. Dave Fryant from Nerdarchy was on the show with us once upon a time back when we were 3DMs. And so the first question I have for Dave as we get this show up and running today is, why are there so many Daves who play D&D in New Jersey?
I don't know for sure. I mean, it might be as long as we never play in the same game together, I think everything is fine and the rift will remain intact. So I can't really quite answer that question because I personally have never met another Dave who plays D&D from New Jersey.
Hmm. Well, the more you know, I guess.
So we have Dave from Tactical Tokens here on today because he is the creator of everybody watching at home. Y'all ready for this? These Bad Jacksons. Wapah! Tactical Tokens. These are really cool little badass things. Side story. I was lurking on Twitter as I'm one to do. And a friend of the show.
We have a Twitter.
Yeah. Friend of the show, Luke Hart, actually was talking to, Dave here about something on Twitter. And I jumped in and checked out some of the product. And I was like, oh, this is neat. And then a little while later, Dave had posted, would anybody, any of these D&D podcasts like to have me on? And I was on top of that shit.
You jumped on that like a hawk. I want to say briefly in praise of these, having gotten a chance to handle them, they have the nice trifecta of being durable, affordable, and useful. So I recommend them because, I mean, to use perhaps more derogative words, they're cheap. They're quite cheap. And they're going to last no matter pretty much what you do them as long as you're not taking hammers to them. So I think they're an excellent addition to any table which uses battle maps.
They survived the hammer test. They didn't do well on the sledgehammer test.
Noted.
Oh, so we did do the hammer test.
Yes, we did. So, Dave, good enough. How did all this come to be? Let's plug your product early and fast before we get to combat.
Which is what people are here for, but we're here for you, Dave. So
awesome. Well, thank you, guys. So how did the backstory of Tactical Tokens is so closely mirrors my own personal D&D backstory, where as soon as I started my foray into dungeon mastering only a couple years ago at this point, I also began my quest to find, either a cheaper way to accomplish what I wanted in game or a more effective way. And essentially what I wanted to accomplish was actually have the picture or the mini of whatever creature I slammed down on the table to actually be there instead of the typical, I have 1,000 goblin minis, so this one's also going to be.
This one's a bugbearer and this one's an elf.
I wanted to avoid that. And I couldn't see a product, or after months of searching for a product, I didn't find one. So it's like, all right, I'll just start, doing product design and testing on my own. And a few months of that later, came up with their current design and just absolutely fell in love and had one of those eureka moments of like, oh my gosh, this could totally help so many other people. I need to start this now. And, yeah. I didn't sleep for a month during the Kickstarter, and now we're here.
Your Kickstarter has been funded, right? Yep.
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah, that was back in, I think I launched that in September. Maybe it ended in September. I forget. It's all a blur since then.
Well, you haven't slept in a month, so.
Yeah, understandable. I do want to say that I especially like these because I do something very similar. Most of my games are run on Roll20, and I like to cut images into a circular pattern and use those as tokens. These strike very close to home for me.
Paul, have you used his token-making tool for Roll20 on his website?
I have not, no.
It's a revelation.
so I don't have to use LunaPick anymore and get everything coming out as a gift for no reason.
I made, are you ready for this? I made 15 fresh tokens in 2 minutes.
Oof. That was good.
I was churning them out. It was just boom, boom. It was like having a stamp.
I mean, I know I'm usually the negative one, but this strikes very close to home for me. So
yeah, no, prepare to be excited. All right. Awesome. So I do have a couple of fun, just, you know, little questions, because one thing I am very curious about as a person who just talks about D&D and plays it is the people who try to venture into the market of peripherals for it. Mm. And, you know, extra stuff. How have you found the marketplace to be like in terms of advertising and getting, you know, making production ends and all that stuff? Like, from a business end, how is it getting into the D&D pool?
Because nerds have a lot of money. So
yeah, we do have a lot of disposable cash for our hobby.
I think the market of nerddom could be a lucrative one, but I've found that running a gaming business, or at least a tabletop adjacent business, has been two things mostly: very expensive and incredibly rewarding at the same time.
So those two kind of cancel out, is what you're saying?
So far they have been. Yeah, they've canceled out. But the rewarding part comes from the community of either players or customers or clients, depending on what path your business takes. But it's podcasts like this, other D&D tabletop creators that I've sought out. So to touch on the marketing side of things, I have done minimal traditional or digital advertising, like Facebook ads and that kind of thing. And I know they're effective, and I'll eventually get there. But I like the connections I've made since launching the Kickstarter.
The sort of underground word of mouth connections, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Those have been by far my favorite connections and the most return on investment in terms of both effort and money. Because a lot of people are just trying to do the same thing, either grow their own audience or just help others enjoy a hobby that they too enjoy. So that's what I'm all about, at least at this stage in my running the business.
Yeah, makes sense.
Well, you know, that is wholesome and that is delightful to hear. But after all of that, we're here for the blood and guts of today's show. We're talking about what 80% of the damn game of D&D is based around, at least the books and the sheets. And
what your paraphernalia is for. So.
Yeah. Why we need all this hot product. Combat.
The knife fighting of D&D.
Yeah. So there's literally a lot to cover here. The way I think we're going to tackle this today is we're just going to hit a lot of different sides and things that a lot of DMs and players don't necessarily think about. You know, this isn't going to be a nuts and bolts, you know, plus.
You know how to run a direct combat. It lays out in D&D. You know how to make the attack rolls and the hit point losses and death and so on and so forth. We're going to talk about more of the stuff adjacent to all that.
So let's go first things first. The very first thing I actually want to lead off with is I want to have a quick talk about theater of mind versus having a 5x5 grid or a 10x10 or however, whatever grid you prefer to use as far as combat goes. Because I mean, if we're going to talk combat, we got to talk about how your players are seeing it and how your players are using it. Personally, I think a 40-60 approach, like small fights that don't have a whole lot going on. It's just there to kill stuff. We do the theater of mind thing because it's quick. It's easy.
You don't need a map to describe you fighting three goblins in a small hut.
But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of rules that are attributed to the battle mat. And I guess really to get into it, if you want to look at people who are really good at both things that are very prominent, an excellent theater of mind DM would be Griffin McElroy, that McElboy who runs the Adventure Zone with his brothers and his dad.
Of the McElroy clan.
Yeah, they, you know, they have no video, and every single combat is literally run theater of mind. And he does a bunch of great descriptive techniques that you can add to really help if you're trying to flesh out a game. One of the things Paul picked up Paul, go ahead.
So one of the things I noticed that I personally have used for Theater of the Mind unconsciously, but I try to do more actively nowadays, is if I'm running a Theater of the Mind combat, I try to describe things in location to landmarks. So you don't need to describe how far apart the combatants are. Just have like a couple of different zones. It's like, for the example I was using is in the beginning, if I believe the third arc of the Adventure Zone, they get into a fight in a swamp and they've got like next to the down tree, the upright trees, and the burned tree. And everybody's in proximity to one of those three things. And that's how they determine range. Because if you're in the same zone, you're at close range. But outside of that, you're at medium to long range. And I think that's very important because a lot of characters' different abilities depend on the ranges of combat. Like no matter how good at swinging a sword you are, you're not going to hit somebody outside of melee range with it. Until we get outside of Dungeons & Dragons, we're going to ignore that for now.
Yeah.
But so if you don't need to necessarily describe exactly how far apart things are, describing things by landmark is what I find the most useful.
Dave, you got anything to contribute to the theater of the mind, even though it affects your bottom line as a business owner who sells combat peripherals?
Oh, no. I agree with if the combat is especially small enough, it's not even worth breaking out the grid. Especially if you think it's only going to take a few turns.
Yeah.
To note on the proximity thing, I've used the couple times I've run Theater of the Mind, I've used like the three ranges I'd keep track of is like melee range within one movement outside of and then outside of one movement away.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. Well, we keep talking in the Paul show. I'm going to say that some other games I've played most recently, Exalted 3rd Edition does a different thing as opposed to the usual grid movement, which is much more like the landmark thing, is everyone's in a certain different range band. There's five for combat, and you've got close range, medium, short range, medium range, and long range, and everyone's just in relation to those. So you've got, instead of having a grid, you've got like a line that everyone is standing on this many moves away. Huh. I think that's interesting.
I like that.
Yeah. Alternatively, when we look at the other side of the spectrum, we have the big old battle mat. And if there is a better example of a DM, I can't really think of one because Matt Colville with all of the resources – or not Matt Colville. Wow. Botch. Matt Mercer with his all of his resources that he has at his available
disposal.
To him. Yes, available to him and at his disposal. Does a lot of very intricate big fights since, you know – Critical Role makes a ton of money and a lot of people throw a lot of stuff at them to
advertise it because it's better advertising than they're going to get otherwise.
So. Yeah, pretty much. You know, he has these big, excellent looking fields of battle and all all this stuff. One of the best parts about doing and why you would want to do a big battle map in the first place is it gives you a lot more you can interact with. Instead of just describing the room and people punching and kicking, you can have terrain that's, you know, impacting or affecting a lot more easily construed. Obviously, most of the rules of this game are written specifically for, you know, 5x5 or 10x10 with, you know, distances and all these things measured. One of the big problems obviously you run into though is it drags combat on. I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's happened to every DM. You're running a combat and then even though it's like, okay, this combat isn't that serious. You've got players who will sit there and analyze this thing like it's the Cuban Missile Crisis, just like looking for
how
problem.
Can I tilt this best to my advantage? And I mean, at a certain point, you just got to say, okay, look, you won. There's one goblin left. He's crippled. Just kill him.
Just end it.
But this goblin could get an attack of opportunity on me and I only have 3/4 of my health left.
Yeah. You know, I will admit there has been, I have had moments of weakness where I have shouted at a player before. I'm just like, just kill the fucking thing. Just end the combat.
I actually had a moment like that this Sunday where they'd killed off everybody except for one person who was only a support unit and couldn't actually do any damage. But they still decided to drag it on for another 3 rounds, chasing it down while it tried to run away. I'm like, we can just say it's done.
Like,
it can't beat
it.
You.
Okay, so, I mean, really quick tips for dealing with the battle mat stuff. Obviously, timers are a godsend. If you can go online, you can buy nice little minute hourglasses. I'm really big on the 1 minute turn rule, unless there is actually something that really does need a lot of thinking. Other things that help is using the good old standard American baseball. method where it's, you know, okay, you're calling out who's on and who's up and, you know, okay, it's your turn. You're up next. Your turn is
think about
that.
What you're doing in advance.
Yeah. Get everybody focusing, have phones put away, stuff like that.
I will say I'm going to be a negative Nancy here again. Some character classes do require a bit more thinking as to what they're going to do. Others, especially things like wizards or clerics at high levels, and they've got a dozen spells to glance through and figure out what they're going to use. But I generally agree with a 1 minute time limit generally makes sense.
And if you find that you're the player that tends to slow down combat a little bit, after you make your move, try coming up with different ideas and start it there instead of waiting until you're next up.
Yeah, definitely try to plan your turns in advance.
Because whenever I play a more complicated character, as soon as I do my move, it's, okay, if something like this happens, I'm going to pick one of these paths. If this happens, do one of these.
Yeah.
It makes things run a lot smoother, but I still take a lot of time at Jake's table when I play a bard.
Well, actually, though, that does segue into, a bit that I wanted to do a little later, but now is a good time to talk about. This one's more directed at DMs, but, you know, players do take
keep your ears
note. No, it's about coaching newer players up. And because I feel like this is another common thing I see all the time on forums and stuff, like DMs asking for advice on how to deal with. Sometimes you have players who are just bad. They don't understand how mechanics work. I don't know what it is, but I've had like 80% of every valid Vengeance Paladin I've ever had is just really bad at playing Vengeance Paladin.
It's not hard. You move and you smite.
Well, they have to smite. They have to set up certain spells. They forget about like their auras and the lay on hands. Like Paladin's low key kind of.
Yeah, there's more moving parts than I was actually, you know, laying credence to. I was just making a joke.
Yeah, I always forget my lay on hands.
Yeah, everybody forgets about lay on hands until it's time for backhanded healing.
Slap magic.
Yes, good old fashioned slap magic. So, I mean, I guess one of my biggest tips for that, though, is if you have a player who is kind of bogging down combat just because they
don't know what to do.
Yeah, they're not confident. One of the things that's worked best for me, actually, I wrote down like a, you know, follow your own path kind of flow chart. I did that for Tom with his paladin once upon a time. He lost it, but he used to have it. And when he had it, the combat would go so smooth because it's like, have you casted your Oath of Enmity yet? Yes, no. Oath of Enmity. Have you prepared a smite yet? Yes, no. Prepare a smite. Have you kicked something's ass yet? Go kick its ass. Okay, yeah. Now you're paladining at a 12th grade level, an advanced readership. You're in AP paladin classes now. You've made it.
I want to say that's more generally true for pretty much everything we're going to say is going to be generally true for just about every system. So don't feel the need to limit this advice just to D&D. Anyway.
And life. Write down a flowchart for somebody. Dave, do you have any...
I love that flowchart idea, honestly.
It's...
I'm glad to hear it.
It has saved a lot of time with some players because it's, you know, you got to remember, everybody learns differently, and just illustrating it in a different way to players because you can stick the book in front of them as long as you want and, you know, hit their knuckles with rulers and shit, but that's not going to fix somebody, you know, having a hard time comprehending the information. Mm-hmm. But moving on from that, on to our next bit. So, you know, back kind of to the top of our order, with combat, you know, I wanted to get that a little bit out of the way, but with combat, here's another thing I really wanted to address with how we do combat. So for me personally, you know, let's talk about when the fight actually starts, when the players have either ticked somebody off or something is just naturally ticked at them or whatever has happened that fate has coincided that everybody is going to now have a wrestling match.
It looks like a brawl is brewing.
And so your combat's about to start, and this one's more for DMs. But one of the things I really love to do is I try to keep in perspective what this fight is affecting. In the back of my mind, one of the things I really like to have, you know, just locked in there is why is this fight happening? Is this fight over a fatal issue? Meaning, you know, is this something that people would kill over?
Why are people getting in a fight?
Or are they, is this a issue that can just be, you know, resolved by getting your ass kicked a little bit and then, okay, I'm sorry.
Not every fight has to be to the death. In fact, most fights probably shouldn't be to the death because that doesn't make much sense. Most people are not willing to die over a bunch of power tools and some boards.
Very true.
You spilled my beer. Now you die.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a second. But, you know, the main thing with a fight or another thing with a fight like that that I try to keep in mind is how the law is going to feel about that fight. You know, how John Q. Lawman is going to find your little throwdown. Cause sure, let's paint a quick picture.
Who's going to jail and for how long?
There goes the camera.
I'll try to fix it.
Nacho's got it.
I knew this was going to happen.
I blame Ben. Anyway. He tripped the cord.
Now fight.
Anyways. So when it comes down to combat, where was I? Yeah. So how does the law feel about it? And painting word picture really fast, you know, imagine that you're in the tavern, yada, yada, yada. Generic tavern things are happening and a group of loud scoundrels, you know, the nice half-elf waitress girl walks by and let's say that one of the guys is, you know, just slaps her ass as she walks by.
Paladin sees this.
Yeah, paladin sees this or barbarian sees this or whatever, goes over there and starts shit. Now, kicking his face in, perfectly fine. Murdering him, obviously, is not going to be something that's acceptable.
If you solve all your problems with violence, you'll soon find that all your problems will be solved with violence in return.
Yeah. So, you know, try to keep a legal precedent in head because I often find that a lot of players think that just because they have they're in the moral right, thinks they are also in the legal right. And that's something that you should – if you're running that kind of a game where you try to take those more realistic aspects seriously, that is something you should definitely try to be cognizant of as you
are. What punishment is there going to be for killing somebody? And in that matter, what punishment is there going to be for hurting somebody? In pretty much every game that takes place in a remotely civilized location, you should at least be aware of what the law thinks about this kind of vigilantism. Because, I mean, sure, it might probably be the morally right thing to do to dissuade somebody from slapping a waitress's ass. But if you kill them, I'm pretty sure almost everyone is going to think that's a bit overkill. And I believe when we were discussing this, Jake came up with an excellent comparison to this. Or not comparison, like an excellent point. Which is like, so what's the legal status of, say, an owlbear? Because people are obviously going to be less likely to kill humanoids. But what about the creatures that aren't humanoids? What's the legal protections on them?
Yeah. You know, what if, yeah, the players run into an owlbear in an area they don't know and they kill it and they bring it into town, you know, and, oh, yeah, I got bits of owlbear. Whoa, that animal's sacred here. What?
It's an endangered species, you asshole.
Yeah. How dare you? How dare you? Are you a poacher? You know, you can have a lot of fun with little stuff like that. But just considering, you know, what any legal ramification might be. And then the last ramification you should probably be aware of before the fight starts is, will anybody need to retreat? And
yeah, that's another thing is, unless you're fighting against absolute fanatics, things that are entirely mindless like zombies, or people who have no means of retreat, generally speaking, at some point morale is going to break and they are going to run away. Very few people will fight to the death.
So.
Well, I mean, one or two people might in a crowd if they're still backed up by their buddies, but most mobs aren't going to survive to be killed off one at a time.
Well, I was, you know, another thing I want to point out too, though, because it's a two-way street that we have here as a problem, and that is that on one hand, we have enemy combatants who act like video game NPCs where even though, you know, 40 of their friends just got eviscerated.
They can't eviscerate all of us. I bet he's real tired after eviscerating those first 40 guys.
Yeah, he's still standing there shouting generic NPC lines.
That's the Dragonborn.
Yeah.
He's played dragons. Let's rob him.
Oh, geez. I was trying to think of all the Fallout 4 lines and I can't think of. Shouldn't have come here. You know, just random shit like.
Can't wait to count out your coin.
Yep. You know, all these random, you know, they're not going to do that. But at the same time, there is a inherent problem with D&D in that the party a lot of parties think that just because a problem has been put in front of them, that means that problem can be beaten very
by
easily.
Their current,
yeah, by like their current standards. Level and force.
I actually have a pretty good example of that.
Oh, hit us.
So, when I last game I was running, the party was out camping, and one of the characters that doesn't sleep, they're sitting there on watch, and it's like, yeah, as you look to the south, you see a group of six owlbears traveling from east to west. They weren't coming towards them. It's, hey, as you look this way, they are just walking across a clearing.
You know, so it's like a fun little description thing.
Yeah, they woke up the whole party, immediately started fighting them, started to get their asses kicked because they were underleveled for owlbears, and they were just walking through, minding their own business. And then eventually my party's like, wait, let's try to talk it out with them. And I ended up playing it by ear, and it's like, okay, well, these owlbears like shiny stuff, so now they're taking away their gold. And it's like, yeah, you got mugged by owlbears that wanted nothing to do with you.
Yeah,
you got reverse mugged by owlbears. You tried to mug them, and then they mugged you.
But let's, yeah. Dave, what do you got to say about retreating? Because there, I got a thing to jump into about smart retreating, but I really want to hear what Dave has to say about this.
Well, in something I've used for the enemies, which we might get into a little bit more later, is stealing, almost using the bloodied half HP thing from 4E as like a cue for some of the enemies of like, ooh, we might not win this one. Let's get out of here.
An excellent point. Another great feature of 4th edition was the bloodied condition, where if a monster has lost more than half of its health, it is considered bloodied, which is affected by many different abilities.
Yeah.
It's also a good time for you to mention to player characters, hey, this guy has less than half HP left.
It's a nice – well, it's a nice little rallying cry. It's remained in my lexicon even though, you know, we play 5th edition.
I think all of us here at the table still use bloodied.
Because, yeah. Well, it definitely lets the players know, like, without me having to, like, describe the cellular degrade of a human being as he's taken, like, 15 attacks, and only now is he actually really looking like he's hurt. You know, bloodied is just
his Wheaties.
Yeah, bloodied is a great way just to, you know, let the party know, oh, okay, we're in the home stretch. We got him halfway.
He's looking pretty banged up. He can barely walk.
Yeah.
There's blood everywhere, and the toilet still isn't fixed.
But as far as retreat goes, you know, if you want to have retreat things in your game, this is another part of the whole retreat issue that is a two-way street. The players need to try to be cognizant of the fact that, like, hey, running is sometimes a very smart thing
to
do.
It is a valid option. You should not just charge headlong at every challenge and expect to get through it by providence alone.
One of my favorite quotes of all time is, we're not retreating, we're advancing in the opposite direction.
That's what we do.
You know, for whatever reason, players think that if they just run away from a fight, they lose the game, which is not true. There's so much that can be gained from it.
Now, to be fair, the game itself for a long time did encourage this by only giving out experience when you killed monsters, which is why there was a sort of a take no prisoners and kill them all attitude going on, which I personally disagree with, as I've mentioned before.
And on the other side, too, though, DM needs to let the party know up front, like, hey, I might throw some stuff at you guys that you won't be able to beat. And you need to be aware that running away should be an option if that's how you want to play. If you're very good about crafting your encounters and you haven't accidentally smoked a party yet, then good on you. You don't really need to heed this advice too much. Actually, I want to move on to the 4th edition stuff, though, since we already mentioned Bloodied, and now's a really good time to bring it up.
There's some good ideas to steal from 4th edition, given that it was one of the most combat-heavy editions.
Oh, it was entirely – like, the entirety of the game was combat-focused, and all the abilities are combat-based, and there wasn't as much – there was a much smaller emphasis put on role play and exploration, and it was more just about that murder all the time. And because of that, some of the stuff that didn't make it from 4th edition to 5th edition is really great to use on your end. I still love – obviously, we just talked about Bloodied. I still love minion rules.
Minions, for those of you not in the know, are monsters that only have one hit point and die to any serious attack.
Yeah. Any attack that actually breaches the skin kills a minion. But where minions are fantastic is if, you know, you're fighting 20 orcs. We got the orc encampment thing going on. There's, you know, you got your big boss orc, you got your two lesser orcs, and then there's about 15 other orcs running around, 15, 18. And you don't need all of them to have their full 13 to 20 HP. You can have them
drag out combat unnecessarily for something that doesn't have any story weight.
Yeah, you can have them. So how minions worked, where like the point of putting a minion in versus just the very weak version of the regular monster is the minion did more damage. Its standard weapon attack damage was a little bit higher. So you put a minion in, it hits a lot harder, but it also just gets dropped in one hit. Also, minions have the very nice side effect too of making players feel like absolute badasses, fucking units. Yes. Yeah, no, like the fighter feels like when a fighter can just
clean his way through an entire crowd of goons in like two turns.
He's like, yeah, can.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the, or when a spellcaster can drop an AoE spell that just, you know, murders about 15 people in one shot. That's a pretty good feeling. You know, can definitely really impact that your players are very powerful people in the setting.
It definitely adds to heroic fantasy, and I use it in a lot of games. Not even just D&D. I use it in, for example, I use it in Shadowrun, Exalted. I've used it in Ad Ava occasionally, stuff like that.
Dave, did you play a lot of 4th edition?
I didn't play a lot of it, but that's where I started my D&D career, was 4E.
There's nothing like your first edition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even if you hate it nowadays.
Second edition.
Like 3.5. Yeah. Just sometimes longingly look at 3.5. What happened? We used to be.
What happened to you? What happened to us?
Now I look at second edition. It's like, I don't even remember how to do my armor class.
I don't even know you anymore.
AC 0.
Second edition looking at Nacho. Who are you?
So I do also want to add that while we mentioned minions and cinematic weight and feeling like a badass, you should probably ask yourself at a fight of why this fight is happening. Quite frequently in games other than Dungeons & Dragons, I have fights just sort of like if the fight is clearly incredibly one-sided, like I was in a kung fu game and I was facing off against some mooks before getting to the big bad guy, I would probably say to them, yeah, you just beat up these two goons. Like they're not going to threaten you, so just don't even bother making a fight for it.
Well, I do think though with the way the character sheet is really weighted, you know, and there are a lot of players who just, you know, they're not here for story, they're not here for role play, they are here to use dice to murder things that are in their brains, which is when you describe D&D like that, that's a really fucked up form of therapy.
I mean, this is going to be a hot take, but like if a fight isn't contributing something to the overall story or to character development, I'm not necessarily sure it should happen.
Well, there are ways you can tie a lot of these quick added combat encounters in. And, you know, I guess this is the part where we just talk about the big boss villains. But first, Dave, you said you've been DMing for about 2 years. What's your favorite big bad guy monster? Because that's a question I just love asking everybody who's on.
I haven't had too many opportunities to really get to play the big bad yet, but my two favorite that I've touched on so far was an orc chieftain that I gave a second initiative slot to.
Nice. I'm going to mention something about that later, but go mm-hmm. on.
That was really fun. And then my other favorite, which I hope to reintroduce to one of my parties very soon, because they had a encounter with her previously, was an Aranes from one of the Nine Hells with 3 hits every round, like a multi-attack of 3 hits. So that was another one that was very fun to unleash on a low-level party.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Lord alive.
They all made it out alive somehow. They actually used the retreat option. I'm so proud of
Isn't it messed up, though, when you're actually like, hey,
yeah, they run away. They ran away.
I feel like it's weird. I feel like a soccer dad after the team, like after the team lost, you know, like your 8-year-olds lost their soccer game. Hey, you did really good out there, champ. It's going to be okay. I'm still proud of you.
It's a good way to pump up villains too, if your players actually occasionally run away.
Yeah. If I can get players to run away from an encounter they shouldn't be beating, That makes me feel really proud of my players because it's like, hey, they realized they can die. They understand their mortality.
You understand that man is mortal.
Absolutely.
But, you know, when it comes to making a big bad encounter, so this is a problem 5e's had that I think they're finally really figuring out how to address.
This is a problem not just with D&D, but this is a problem for most games is single big bad monsters rarely work out because it ends up like one of those scenes from, I don't know, like from a cop show where the big bad guy strolls up and then five people rush him and curb stomp him for the next 5 minutes.
Yeah. You know, when there's, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about action economy. I think that's probably going to get blended in here. But, I mean, the biggest problem is action economy. When you have one big monster with a ton of HP, not a whole lot of, you know, time to do stuff against five smaller individuals who are just going to be chipping away the entirety of the time, it's not going to last, especially if it has a really bad initiative roll.
Yeah.
If you have a, you know, a young, like a dragon or an adult dragon or whatever, and you have a party that is appropriate level to take it on, but that dragon only gets like a 4 on its initiative, there is a good chance that half
it's going to get locked down really quickly.
Yeah, half of its HP might get, you know, just walloped away in that first turn before it can even breath weapon, and everybody's going to be able to spread out and get all their stuff in. Legendary actions obviously help with things like this, but it still can – there's been plenty of fights. You know, I can remember one fight particularly that just really broke me as a DM was I made a custom Hydra that was going to be the – it was the big final boss of a – you know, dungeon. I didn't fiddle with the HP, but each head had a different thing on it and stuff. And I was like, oh boy, this'll teach these assholes. And they nuked it in one turn. The paladin crit, on two attacks, blew half of its health away. And then everybody else just like the two spellcasters just elbow dropped it with spells. And all of like my hour and a half of like balancing everything and making sure it was right was gone, just gone in the dumpster. And,
yes, yeah. I think that's happened to all of us, at least in some way.
Yeah.
As you throw in a big monster and the players wreck it. What were you going to say, Nacho?
I said, yep, I've been there.
Yeah, it's happened to all of us, but there are ways around it.
So I'm going to give to you a special product. It's called More Than One Turn in the Initiative Order, or you might know it by its brand name, Celerity. Make it roll initiative twice, it acts on both of those. The bigger and more important is give it more initiatives. Or the other one is...
More reactions.
At Ava has a thing where, because it's usually a fight of five mechs on one monster, is the monster gets a turn after every single player turn, which is obviously terrifying, which is the point, given that it's fighting one versus five. So I think you can definitely do something like that. The contradictory advice I'm about to give here is don't mess with the action economy, but if you want to make a single big threatening guy, mess with the action economy.
Well, if you don't want to go that far out, homebrew, you know, off system using other stuff from other systems, there's still a couple of ways within the system you can swing it a little bit better. One thing I really like that 5e's been doing a lot with a lot of the recent books is suddenly we're seeing a lot more smaller CR'd monsters have,
legendary actions
and legendary resistances and just a big old bloated health pool. Matt Mercer actually, again, gets a lot of credit here because if you go to Critical Role and watch some of his bigger fights, you'll notice that like a lot of things have way more HP than they deserve any right to be. Like
Dark Souls boss style.
Yeah, Dark Souls boss style. Like even though there's, you know, however many people they have on Critical Role per week because the roster change is 6 or 7, you know, even though sometimes there'll be 7 people wailing on one person or 8 if they have a guest, it's got an extra 300 hit points, so it can soak it.
Yeah, that's something I was going to bring up is that's actually – I'm going to completely contradict you here. That's something you also kind of want to avoid is if it's – the boss can also be too tough. In the game I ran Friday, they were fighting a boss enemy, but they were doing like 1 or 2 damage a turn to its 45 hit points. So it took them 8 turns of their barbarian equivalent sitting on its chest and full attacking them every round before they finally killed it. That's obviously on the far end of the spectrum of that you need to – it's a careful balancing act, you know?
Yeah, there have been times where I'll either cut the HP because I put too much on there and then
just don't tell your players, yeah.
Yeah, later on, I started having a number in my head, and they nuked it around here. I'm just going to start adding hit points because I clearly
players avert wrong. Your ears. We're going to tell you how much GMs cheat here. I'm sure we've all done it. A monster died too quickly. We just give it an extra 15 hit points, and nobody noticed.
Oh yeah, and this can surprise reaction attack.
Yeah. Well, it's still, you know, you obviously you build to these big encounters. You want these encounters to really mean something. I think we get back to the retreat issue again, because if, you know, something's too big and they're having a hard time with it, then, you know, there's no reason they can't run away and then hit it again when they're a little bit more powerful. Alternatively, scouting is always something that could help.
Yes, that's something I was actually going to mention. Wow, I'm talking a lot today. Maybe I should just let somebody else talk.
Oh, no, I'm enjoying seeing Paul talk. You're out of roll.
I like this newfound confidence.
So this is something that was brought to me by one of my players who played a rogue in my last Dungeons & Dragons game, is without scouting, rogues don't really have much of like difference between their builds. They want to get behind somebody and do sneak attacks. Like, no matter how you build your rogue, if you're not doing scouting or conning or other stuff, the rogue isn't doing much. The scouting opportunity is an excellent time for your rogue or ranger or whatever to shine, in that they sneak up on an encampment, they note how many enemies in their position, and they allow your players to make a perfect tactical choice and move in at the right time. And sometimes to just decide not to fight, just don't play the game. There's 30 orcs in this encampment, there's 4 of us. We're just not going to go in there, like, fuck that. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to go against, you know, 30 British football hooligans with muscles the size of grapefruits in a fist fight if I can just walk around them.
Well, I mean, you know, I want to get Dave in this conversation too about this. I'm big on, you know, if your villain has lower forces, you know, and this gets back all the way back to the retreating part. If everybody gets their ass kicked and, you know, the big heater of this little group that runs around just got its ass kicked, then why isn't the, you know, the pipsqueak of the group who was going to run anyways, run back to the boss with snot crying, the worst crying, you know, going, "Boss, there's a wizard and he used the fire spell. And James,
insert giant alligator tear.
He's gone."
What were you saying, Dave? Sorry.
I wasn't saying anything, but in terms of what you going back to a bad guy getting out of there and telling the actual big bad what's going on, I love it when a smaller bad guy gets away, because that means a harder encounter is going to hit the party a couple sessions later.
Yeah, that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, that also brings up I did share an article on Facebook the other day about torture in Dungeons and Dragons, which is always just
people seem to resort to torture really quickly.
Yeah, despite the fact that torture doesn't work that well in real life. A lot of people really liked 24, though.
And yeah, I botched that in your game because
6 straight hours
paladin
of pistol
decided
weapon.
To hit the guy I was already torturing.
Yeah,
knocked him out.
I'm not going to comment too much on that because that's kind of a thing for another episode, I suspect, but players tend to resort to torture to get information real quickly for the good guys.
One of my favorite things, just as an aside, one of my favorite things about that is apparently at West Point, they know one of the like instructors there had to has to continually keep telling students that, no, we don't instruct torture here because torture doesn't work. And they're like, so when's torture 102? When do we get to cycle that in?
On your free time, you can go waterboard each other. Not as much fun as it sounds.
Jeez.
Waterboarding sounds like a really sweet extreme sport, which is kind of a shame, really. I'm going waterboarding, Chad.
Listen, Kyle, calm down.
Anyway.
But scouting is a two-way street, though. And it's another thing that, yeah, the players, again, don't really seem to take that much advantage of. And if you're a player, this is another thing you can really add to, you know, making everything better. I think a very generic point I want to put out there is that if in any setting, if there is enough of a thing to be considered a class, like if you were to know what a wizard looks like. Pointy hat, stick with a crystal on the end of it.
Robe with stars on it.
Whole lot of robes. Yeah. Where it has a shit ton of robes, has a big old book with a bunch of things that you can't read on it. That guy's a wizard. You know, cleric, pretty obvious.
Holy symbols everywhere, given that you need holy symbols. You fighters, know. Barbarians, you know, the usual.
Until the barbarian needs something with pockets, so he takes the wizard robes, and the book is really just a giant slab of stone.
We're getting there, don't worry.
Yeah. The, you know, monk and rogue might be the only ones who can hide, but if, you know, you know what these things are, if you're
going to report it back to your boss,
cognizant, yeah, it's like everybody would know what this is. And this leads to, you know, a much deeper combat experience, because if you're the villain, something I'm really big on is if a villain knows that these plucky heroes are coming to stop him from doing whatever he's doing, then he's going to try to drain them of resources. You know, winning a war is not about just straight up murdering the other side. Although if you can do it, it
by all means,
a war
do
pretty
it, but
quick. But, winning a war is about draining them of resources. And draining the party, you know, if you treat it like that, draining the party of resources is a good way to wear them down and build tension in the game. If you're trying to play a very intelligent villain like a blue dragon, then, you know, blue dragon wouldn't just go out there and start strafing them immediately. No, he'd wear them down, make sure that they're out of spells, out of ways to pull their own ass out of the fire, and then he'd strafe them.
And he'd probably start sending out specialized hit teams to deal with the PCs once he gets some information back. And again, that's true for any setting and any game, is if your opponents know what the players can do, they're going to start specializing to counter that. They're not just going to keep throwing a generic goon squad A at them. And that's when you mix things up by having the wizard wear some full plate and throwing the monk in the wizard robe. So when they rush down the man in the dress, I get the shit kicked out of them. So that's a story for another time.
You know, well, just shaking it up a little bit.
I'm a muscle wizard.
I believe it was punch wizard.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. I cast fist.
Hey, it's a great spell. I've used it personally myself. No, but there's, you know, there's so much that can be said for specific things like that, like positioning and the scouting knowledge and stuff. Because that's actually another thing that I hear all the time, too, is players complaining about sometimes that, you know, they're being targeted or singled out for what class they are. Like, you know, the wizard, you know, complaining that, oh, they're always attacking me. You're trying to kill me. I'm going to just put this very, you know, politely. You're the fucking wizard. The standard of Geek the Mage would exist in any in any setting where there is a person who can literally shape the forces of the universe into a coalescent power and aim it at shit.
And you look pretty frail and sickly to me, so.
Well, no, you know what's
Geek the Mage first, as this adage goes.
Listen, the, you know, the guy with the golden battle axe that's, you know, being lit up by the power of his god, that's something worrisome.
We'll move him down on the priority list a bit.
I want to run around him. I don't want to try to beat that wall up. The rogue that's, you know, I saw him jump in the bushes. I haven't seen him in 5 minutes.
He's probably gone. He ran off.
Hopefully he's not there, and hopefully I don't get stabbed. Meanwhile, the guy who really concerns me, the dude who can blow shit up with his brain and words, that is a problem. Learning positioning as a player is something that if you're going to play a wizard or anything like that in a fairly, tactical minded game like this, definitely just try to mind your P's and Q's of where you are. It's not much of a hard lesson, but some players just need to be reminded of it. Doing something, just rushing out there, you know, and just to get there and, hey, I ran out here and, you know, trying to be cognizant of what's going on around you within a quick, orderly fashion, because this is how we get into the hemming and hawing part of
there's also battle mapping. This is definitely a battle map exclusive thing. If you're doing the sort of positional theater of the mind, this isn't as relevant, but like, still, it's something to be concerned about.
Yeah. Dave, you got any thoughts?
Insights? Wisdom?
Well, especially if you're playing wizard, know your spell ranges. Like, if that's the only thing you know, if that's one of the only things you know about your list of spells, is which ones can you cast at distance or at great distance, or which ones do you need to be up close?
Yeah, and you should probably be trying to cast those the longest range you can if you're especially squishy.
And also knowing spells too, like you know, your reaction spells and what spells you can get away with on a bonus action too, because that is actually go to what is it, Donjon? Yeah, Donjon. They have a great spell list that you can sort by the action
type.
Yeah, by the action type. And that is a fantastic utility. Because you can, yeah, you can build entire, especially as a DM, you can build very useful spell lists completely based around that. That also, I guess, relating back to that coach 'em up thing we said earlier, I have written a lot of spell lists for players. And if you're having a player who's just having a hard time, like, picking spells and they get locked down when I don't know what to do, then you're just like, and this is what you know. And just, you know,
pick from this list and cast a spell.
Yep, pick these, you know, whittle it down for them, make it a little easier. Let's see, final big things we got. We got about 10 minutes left here on the show.
Wow, that went quick.
It did.
It goes quicker than you think every week.
Yeah.
So something else I was going to say is especially I just want to keep getting back to this, is why is this fight happening? Like, I know Dungeons & Dragons has this assumption that you're going to be doing 5 to 6 fights every day just to keep things balanced, and nobody does this, which is a big part of the reason that Dungeons & Dragons is seen as an unbalanced game, is if you're going to have to get through 5 or 6 fights a day, you're going to have a lot less spells, and the wizards can't just go Nova every time. But why is this fight happening? Is it just happening for a random encounter, or does this have any actual relevance to what's going on? Does it have relevance to a character, or is it, again, this is an opportunity for you to do your fighting thing?
I guess, well, it does, you know, ultimately, you should be able to find a way to make narrative out of every combat decision.
Yeah, of course, but I generally am of the impression that things should erupt from the narrative rather than necessarily from the gameplay. At the very least, going back to your example with the barmaid getting her ass slapped by some disrespectful customers, at the very least, that helps characterize the paladin and the barbarian who leap into action. But if you're just saying along the road, you run across, roll some dice, 2d3 owlbears plus 1 ent, and you're wondering how the heck this happened, maybe this fight just shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, that was like with the story I shared. They were just kind of walking by, but the players decided they wanted to turn it into a combat.
Well, obviously you can't just tell the players, no, you can't do that. But if you're going to set up a fight, at least try to make it come from the narrative first, I think.
Well, I mean, trust me, I agree with you completely. We've had a lot of long talks about this, and we're on the same page. But simultaneously, I do think that every now and again, you just need to have a dumb combat every now and again, because sometimes story erupts from combat. There is, you know, there's a lot of times where, you know, for example, a really good example is that insanely lucky guard. You know, let's say you just use a standard guard stat block, right? And there's 12 of the other guards, and, you know, there's the evil lord, and he's riding around on his horse that he's named, you know, Pantomime or some dumb shit. And he's, you know, riding around and, you know, I have beaten you again. And he's riding off, and, you know,
the guard pegs him with an arrow.
No, the guard that's on, you know, his side, you know, he runs away, you know, on his fucking horse named Pantomime. And you've got this one guard who, compared to the rest of the guards, is actually doing shit. Your guys can't hit him. He is kicking everybody's ass. Like, he's getting really good rolls, or he's even getting crits on your party and stuff. Suddenly, you know, this one guard number 6 is no longer guard number 6. Okay. This is Geralt. And Geralt is a bad, bad man. Okay. Suddenly, Geralt, you have a name and you have an increased stat block because
and he's going to survive, and he's going to come back with a wicked scar on his eye and challenge the players again.
But it's shit like that, though. Like, sometimes random encounters can actually lead to adding to the story. So just a counterpoint to that, to what you said before, because I agree with you. But every now and again, something really great can come out of just a dumbass fight.
I guess we can chalk it down to differences in GMing style, I'm afraid.
Now, just something from our chat. Okay, Dave, you have any thoughts on this? And we're gonna be wrapping up here in about 5 minutes.
Nah, do your thing.
All right, bet. Last little bit that I want to try to get to today.
To touch on, certainly.
Yeah, is, well, it's two things. It is how the dice are going to roll and player planning, which means, you know, the classic, I'm going to drop the chandelier on them bit.
Yes, this is something I actually wanted to talk about but completely forgot about, so thank you. I want to swing down from the chandelier and attack them.
That's cool. Yeah, that is cool. That should take at least just one skill check.
Yeah. So something I just overall want to say is don't punish your players for trying to do something cool unless you want the game to inevitably devolve in a sort of mid-room fight where everyone just stands there and hacks each other with swords. Rules as written, to swing from a chandelier and attack somebody would probably require three or four attack rolls. I would make it require maybe one aside from the attack roll tops. Because otherwise you're just punishing the player with more points of failure for trying to do something interesting and cool. And I'd probably, if they succeeded, give them a bonus in the attack roll anyway.
Yeah. Allowing wacky plans that players come up with. I mean, there is a perfect line that it's a gut feeling thing. You can't, you know, I can't just sit here and go, well, always agree to what the players plan to do. Because sometimes, yeah, it's just not feasible. And sometimes you need to let them do kind of dumb things to remind them that not everything you're going to do is going to work. But at the same time, you should not be a soul. There is a grace period that exists somewhere in between letting them try dumb things and then figuring out that some of their dumb shit will not work. But on the other side, being such a no fun authoritarian that, no, well, that's going
to
take.
I'm going to need you two acrobatics checks and then two attack rolls to get through it because I need to see you fail.
You need an athletics to climb up the chandelier, then an acrobatics to keep your balance on the chandelier. Then I need an attack roll on the chain of the chandelier, and then I need an athletics check and another acrobatics check to stay on. That's fucking dumb.
Or you could just give them one acrobatics check and one acrobatics failed. Well, I guess you and the chandelier both.
Come crashing down anyway.
Just came crashing down on the enemy, and you tried, but now you're taking falling damage.
Yep.
Yeah, something like that.
Along with that, I mean, I guess
just final fail forward.
Yeah, because we're about out of time for this show here. There's still a lot of stuff I want to cover. Quick final thoughts on everything. If you're putting together a combat again, hey, what does the combat actually add to your game? Try to get as much, you know, hey, much like real life, try to get as much meaning out of every moment as you can and ponderate on it. Ponderate. That's not a word. I'm trying here.
Ponder.
Yeah. Ponder. No, I put an 8 on that motherfucker.
Why an 8? 1 out of 10.
Dude, I don't know.
Let's not worry too much about it.
I don't know. Figure out, you know, scouting is always a good thing that needs to happen. Reminding your players they can retreat if we're just going to sum this episode up neatly. And don't be afraid to look at other game systems for great ideas. There's a reason that a lot of these games sell and make enough money to continue to exist and release new editions. And that's because they have good ideas. There are a ton of DMs who are, you know, for encounters, at least one encounter will steal wholeheartedly from another book. You know, it's one of the best tools you have up your sleeves. If you have a table full of people.
Blatant outright theft.
Yeah. If you have a table full of people who know 5th edition really well, they don't know shit about Dark Heresy, do they? Hit them with the pimp they don't know. And, you know, last but not least, I mean, the important part of combat is obviously to flex most of the character sheet. Flesh out, you know, use the fleshed out part of the character sheet. Just try to make things fun,
interesting, or some combination of
the two. Combat can be a very slow, arduous process sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so just doing everything you can to make things entertaining is, you know, what you're being called on, because I've ran a lot of combats that have been shitty, you know, and I've had players just sitting there just like, is it done yet? You know, honestly, it's probably been the weakest part of my game for a long time, and it took me a lot of practice and trying different shit to get to the point where I was like, okay, now I run a great combat. Or at least I feel a lot better on it. But I guess that's my final thoughts.
That's my final thought too, certainly. Well, actually, no, I got one thing to say.
Hit me.
At the end of the day, you're all trying to have fun. If things are getting too bogged down, simplify things.
That.
Simplify it, and then also remember it's not DM versus player.
Yeah, that's another thing. You don't win by making the players lose.
as much as I liked buffing up the enemy's hit points, I didn't do it to kill the players.
You did it for the players?
Yes. So that to make they it wouldn't, interesting. So they wouldn't kill the big bad in half a round.
We really are the villains. Dave, you got any final thoughts for us on combat? Any things you wanted to touch on that we didn't quite get to?
My only final thoughts would be let the players try it. Try it yourself and, you know, reward. If the players do something crazy and it works out, reward them for it.
Yeah. This is definitely a game that highly encourages a lot of failure, you know, testing things out and failure and seeing what works and seeing what doesn't. That's our show for today, everybody. You can, if you're watching this on Twitch, you'll be able to find all of the links for all of our social medias. You can click on them there. You can find this podcast wherever you get your podcast. I'd like to thank Dave for coming on. Dave, where can everybody go to get your awesome shit? Because again, Nacho, sneak over to the camera and hold up the Ebolith token for him. No, because it's fucking amazing.
It's a good token, certainly, yeah.
I've been seeing you guys handle them the whole episode.
Yeah, we can't help but, you know, just play with them. They're so fun.
I have tons near my desk that, like, I use as stress tokens almost.
Yeah, so where does everybody go to buy the stuff? Can we get some prices listed on air for anybody who is interested?
Absolutely. The best place to go is tacticaltokens.com. We got a shop set up there. On there, there's the token stamp that you mentioned earlier. I think it's the fastest one on the internet. Because we don't have borders yet, but we're getting there. You could also we have a build your own bundle thing where if you don't like any of the bundles we currently offer, which we're always adding more, you can just make your own and pick from our entire selection. Some cool things going on in the future is if anybody has played on Roll20 or Fantasy Grounds or any digital or virtual tabletops, you've probably used token illustrations from the amazing Devin Knight. I'm working with him to get his entire 10,000 token illustration thing into our prime material plane. So that will eventually come to Tactical Tokens, hopefully soon.
That's pretty cool.
That's a beautiful lot.
his collection is massive, and it's I don't think I'm going to sleep again.
That's good for you, right, though?
It's totally healthy.
We'll sleep when we're dead.
Exactly. And on that lovely little note, this has been the DM Vault. We'd like to thank everybody for joining us today. We'd like to thank Dave for appearing on the show, and we will be plugging his product relentlessly. Next Sunday, we will actually be on. We have a interview with one Brandon Dixon, the creator of Swordsfall, which I am very, very hyped for. So nice. Tune in. That will be a fantastic show. We're going to talk about a lot of race issues and basically a lot of some of the nastier sides of the hobby. But until then, I'm Jake.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Nacho.
I'm Dave.
Yeah. And we have been the DM Vault. Thank you for watching. Bye-bye.